There's only one thing worse than having a kid brother around the house, and here it is now. Here comes the Colonel.
Oh, yeah. Spoken like a true big brother. Well, welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow, the definitive broadcast program on emerging science, open innovation, nanotechnology. This half hour, we have back again with us this guy, John Hager, who he and his wife, Laura, are living in a house made from recycled rubber tires up in the mountains of Colorado, where it's darn cold, there's plenty of snow, and he's trying to have the electrical grid not take any electricity for the electrical grid, and that's what we were talking about when we broke at the half hour, and we'll be back with more information on that. John's a fascinating person, and you'll get a chance to meet him if you attend the IEEE Green Technology Conference that's coming to the Gaylord, Texas Resort and Convention Center April 15 and 16. This is first-rate IEEE, the social, economic, and political impacts of renewable energy. That's the thing that we've been very interested in right here on this radio program. We've talked a lot about it. We studied what went on in Copenhagen. Well, you're going to get the latest information if you attend the conference that's put on by the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers. There's early discounted exhibitor rates available, incidentally, if you want to exhibit. This radio program is providing that at 214-329-4949. That's 214-329-4949. Or you can link up promiseoftomorrow.biz. That's the name of this broadcast, promiseoftomorrow.biz. Well, we'll be back with John Hager and how he's going to get off the electrical grid right after we check in our very busy newsroom and these headlines with Marissa Vitoles.
Canadian startup Saltworks Technologies has built a pilot desalination plant in Vancouver that may transform the water purification process. Relying on concentration gradients, the plant uses a quarter of the energy of conventional ones, and if scaled, could provide a cheaper way to bring drinking water to parched regions of the world while leaving behind a smaller carbon footprint. New psychology research out of UC San Diego and the University of Toronto indicate the distance between a woman's eyes and the distance between her eyes and mouth are key factors in determining how attractive she is to others. Researchers successfully identified the optimal relation between the eyes, mouth, and the edge of the face for individual beauty through test groups of university students in four separate experiments. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has published a study that increases our understanding of addiction disorders by examining the brain's reward system. They found that the brain requires not only the signal substance dopamine, but also glutamate, suggesting that nerve cells co-transmit these substances. University of Oklahoma scientists have found a way to turn ineffective cancer drugs into cancer fighters by using a chemical compound, SHETA2. The compound triggers cancer cell response and ultimately cell suicide, opening the door to new treatments in the area. Marissa Vitoles reporting from Silicon Valley.
Okay, we're back in the line now with John Hager, who is living in a house made of recycled tires with his wife Laura in the mountains above Denver, Colorado. And we were talking, the last time we had a conversation with him, we're talking about how he's going to get off the electrical grid altogether. That's the plan.
And what we'd like to get to over the course of the year is close to a zero energy footprint for the house. But before we could do that, we kind of had to study what our patterns of usage and collect that data up, since nobody had that kind of data for this kind of house. So we've been working, collecting up that data, and then we'll size the system appropriately. The house is all wired for it. We just have to know how big to make it.
In your photovoltaic, that's solar energy, you wouldn't put that on the roof?
Probably not, partially from an aesthetic standpoint, but also... because we're on a hillside, we have a nice option for running them along the hillside, which makes them a lot easier when you get the snow to brush the snow off of the photovoltaics. If they're up on the roof, you got to climb up on the roof and brush the snow off there, which I'd rather brush them off right next to my driveway.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Colonel, asking dumb questions. All right.
That was a good question.
Okay, what about wind power? Are you going to use any wind power to supplement your electricity?
We live 3 miles from a place called Windy Gap. It's a gap in the the mountains just before you get to the Continental Divide here in Colorado. And so we know we get wind. We've been researching that a little bit. What you have to have is a certain number of days with a certain amount of wind energy. We've been focusing more on the solar side and the photovoltaics than the wind side, but we also want to try and get a weather station at some point in the next year and construct it so that we could also add in a small wind generator to supplement the photovoltaics, say, on a cloudy, snowy day, which, of course, we get up here in Colorado pretty regular.
Yeah, I would figure that would probably be a real nice little hedge, especially since the storage of electricity is not a real easy thing to do right at the moment. Batteries are getting better, but they're not quite there yet. So you would have to really use what electricity you harvest like right away. Or do you have a storage system in mind?
Yeah, you're right about the batteries. We investigated the batteries, me being an engineer. My wife, I should say, is an engineer also. And we just didn't see that the battery technology was quite viable yet. You have maintenance issues and storage and those kinds of things. And because literally one of the power lines passes at the front of our property, it was really easy to tie into that and use the power system to supplement us anytime we didn't have either enough sun or wind. So that made the most sense to us. Not that off-grid isn't nice, it's just we kind of didn't need to do that.
Yeah, and your wife's an engineer too. Does she also work for Lockheed and travel the world as you do, or does she go back and forth to work 2.5 hours in Denver?
No, she got to retire when we moved up here. I got to keep working because of the virtual nature of my job. She is now retired, works on hiking and skiing and nature photography, and we're thinking of writing a book on this whole adventure, too. So she's a technical writer and a software quality assurance engineer. So she'll be the writer of the book. I don't have enough time for that.
So she's got a lot of activities and doesn't get lonesome up there in the mountains without you.
No, she doesn't get lonesome, and we've got some really nice neighbors. It's a very much kind of cooperative situation up in the little valley we're in. Everybody kind of helps everybody else out, largely because we're about 10 minutes from town, not far away from town, but 10 minutes from town, and you have to have the help of your neighbors, and so we all help each other up there quite a bit. So she's got a lot of friends up there.
All right. Now, I know the listeners right now are thinking, gee whiz, where can I see a picture of this house? You have a picture of it online, do you?
We actually have a website. Everybody has a website these days, right?
Yeah.
It's www.hagertirebales.com. I'll spell that out.
Yeah, please do.
Three W's, H-A-G-A-R-T-I-R-E-S, tires, Bales, B-A-L-E-S, Bales.com. You can also, if you don't want to try and write that down, remember that. If you do a Google and Google on tire bales or building with tire bales, we come up as the number one, two, or three website on Google, depending upon Google's mood for the day, along with the other people building these houses. Quite a few of them have some websites, too. But with ours, you get to see the whole process. We go all the way from breaking ground, laying the tires, putting the concrete on, pouring the slab, putting the walls up, the roof, and we've got now pictures of both the inside and the outside of the house, the finished product.
So did you you do the website yourself, or did you hire a webmaster?
I hired my engineering wife. as I said, you know, you diversify in the family. Everybody does what they're good at. I was pounding nails, and she was building websites.
Okay, so if somebody wants to see the house, they should Google tire bales, and that way, and you're sometimes at the top, or at least you're close to the top there, right?
Yeah, it'll be in the first list displayed there. They usually display the first 10 or 15, and we're pretty much, and if we're not number one, we're number two or number three.
Okay, well, that's good. Now, I understand you're participating in the big IEEE Green Technology Conference that's going on in Dallas in the middle of April. Are you a part of that?
Yes, I've been invited speaker. We're going to come down there with some charts and some slides and some data and show the, I'll say, pictures kind of from the beginning to end, along with a lot of the engineering and technology concepts that we've got going. We've got several things we've been working on, a lot of recycling, a lot of these green kinds of concepts, zero energy footprint, those kinds of things. So we're looking forward to presenting at that, and I'll say meeting some people that may be interested in these kinds of concepts and technology.
So anybody that wants to know more about it can come to visit you at the Gaylord Resort Convention Center and Hotel the 15th and 16th of April.
Yep, tax time, huh? So
you didn't have to bring that up now, did you, John?
Well, I have to have my taxes done by the time I come down there, obviously. we will be down there on those days. The presentation will have a lot of the pictures, some of which are on the website, but we'll add in a few other new ones too. Plus, we'll be there to answer questions. And with the website, I think there's a way to contact us. And also, jumping off point for the architectural designer we worked with, the recycling place we worked with, and some associated sites. So that kind of information could be useful to anybody wanting to explore these kinds of ideas with us.
We've been visiting with John Hager, who, along with his wife Laura, live 8,000 feet up the side of a mountain in the Rockies, just above Denver, in a house that's made from recycled tires. And he wants to be independent of the electric grid, and that's what they're trying to do. We can meet John firsthand at the IEEE Green Technology Conference that's going on the 15th and 16th of April. I hope you'll join me there. And if you want to know more about it, you can find out at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. I ran into an old friend recently, Stephen Snyder. You might remember him when we were researching climate change last summer. And we did a whole series on that. Well, Steve is back from Copenhagen, recuperating a little bit from the rough treatment he got over there. And he has written a book, and I know that you're going to ask me the name of it. And I really, forgive me, Steve, but I really don't remember the name exactly of it. It had to do with climate change as a contact sport or something like that. But the good news is Steve is sending us a copy of the book, and then we're going to get to talk about it a little bit, because there's a whole lot of things going on with climate change. Steve is a member of the International Council on Climate Change, International Panel of Climate Change, I should say, the IPCC, with the United Nations. And the last time that we had Steve around, we had a little visit, and this is some excerpts from that time. Well, anyway, Steve, I wanted to ask you, you've advised all these people, and back with Clinton, did you collaborate with Al Gore on his work that he did in Inconvenient Truth?
I didn't collaborate with him on Inconvenient Truth, but in 1981, there was a young congressman from Tennessee named Albert Gore Jr. who held a hearing on funding climate research aimed at answering not whether the climate was going to change, but so what if the climate changes? And there was a very important Department of Energy program, and unfortunately the Secretary of Energy under Ronald Reagan decided that he was going to cut out all environmental research, and that was their mandate. So he applied a meat axe, and that's when I first met Al Gore. And what we kept arguing is that how can you fix a problem you don't understand? We got to invest in understanding it. And I knew at the time that he was especially dedicated to this issue, and that dedication of his grew. And I probably testified to his committee when he was a senator maybe half a dozen times. You know, obviously I've been on programs where he has been, but I've not been an advisor, just basically one of the corps de ballet of scientists who informs decision makers that ask our opinion, and he was one of the prime decision makers who asked that for 20 years.
Well, it's interesting. The listeners should know that after decades of work that you, along with four generations of IPCC authors, received a collective Nobel Peace Prize for your joint effort back in 2007. So you and Gore kind of share that sort of thing. Do you subscribe to his conclusions and Inconvenient Truth?
Well, I agree with a lot of what he says. I don't agree with everything. I frame the problem, as we've been talking about today, as a risk management problem. Remember, the role of scientists is to tell you what can happen and what are the odds. That's risk. Risk is what can happen multiplied times its probability. Risk management is what do you do about it? Well, that's a value judgment about how to spend resources and, you know, how to determine winners and losers. And I certainly would agree with Al Gore that this problem is serious enough that it requires some resources. And then I keep arguing, as we've talked about, Colonel, that we want to have them as much win-wins as possible. He tends not to frame it as much as a risk management problem as I do, sort of as a moral imperative. Now, I don't disagree with that, but that's his framing. My framing is, yes, for me it's a moral imperative, but that's my personal value judgment. I think that society is more likely to be interested in inefficient risk management than in the moral imperative argument, where you just get into all different arguments from people with different opinions. So yes, I certainly endorse the overall thing. Somebody once said, well, does he get it always right? No. I mean, if I tried to correlate the statements of Al Gore with the statements of the IPCC, I think, 80% of the time he's pretty close. Sorry to say this, but if I tried to correlate the statements of Rush Limbaugh, George Will, with the statements of the IPCC, 95% of the time they get it wrong. So I'm certainly more with Gore than with them on this. But in terms of solutions, I tend to frame it more in a business way. You know, every venture capitalist worries about upside and downside risk, and they have to make certain that their whole portfolio is not threatened with downside risk. And I say exactly the same thing about the Earth. You cannot threaten the Earth with a large fraction of potentially irreversible downside risk. You gotta make some safer investments. And in fact, we haven't talked much about technology. That would be something really important. When you asked me earlier, Colonel, about the Waxman-Markey and the cap and trade, and my answer was yes, we need to have a price on carbon in order to get the signals right. At the same time, we need energy efficiency. There's another point that we need just as much, which is we need incentives to private capital to get all those brilliant startups, because we have incredibly smart technologists in this country and in this planet, and the trouble is that they need to get over the hump in investment. So here's where there could be a role for the federal government. We've had a stimulus package because of a crisis, but we don't need a crisis. We should have a stimulus package that's carefully targeted at very good potential new technologies. How can we invent our way out of this problem with high technology? I think we can, not immediately, not in 10 years, but certainly over 30. And create sustainable green jobs, decouple ourselves from dependence on foreign supplies of energy, and at the same time protect the environment. Look for those win-win-wins. So it will take investment. No return on investment without investment. And how much? So I was giving talk in Washington. A congressman said to me, he was in the audience, it wasn't a congressional hearing, just public talk. Okay, I agree with that. He said, we do need public investment. After all, nuclear power was not funded by private sector, it was government. And even the Internet, in spite of the fact that Al Gore supported it, didn't invent it, the Internet, came out of DARPA, which was a defense agency funding. So it's very obvious that all important new technology got started with the government assist, often with military, sometimes direct subsidies. How much did it even cost? I said, well, technology is not cheap, and I don't know, $20, $30 billion a year for the next 10 years. And he said, are you crazy? Don't you read the newspapers? We're in a financial crisis. And I said, excuse me, Congressman, but with all due respect, which anytime anybody says that, look out. Mm-hmm. And I said, didn't we just spend $750 billion of those dollars in 1 year bailing out a bunch of under-regulated greedy bankers? You don't want to spend 4% of that every year for the next 10 years to help us invent our way out of a potential planetary risk, and at the same time, by the way, provide some clean, sustainable jobs and decouple ourselves to some degree from foreign supplies of energy that's unreliable. I said, you know, it just seems to me that this is elementary good investment. And he said, well, I agree with you. He said, but a lot of my colleagues don't. I said, they should look in the mirror and see if they need a values transplant.
Yeah, well,
incredibly capable technological capacity. But how do you get VC in there? Always a little reluctant. Loan guarantees? Heck, we got loan guarantees to losers. How about loan guarantees to winners?
Yeah. Yeah. So you believe then that not only something like cap and trade or carbon tax and, of course, energy efficiency, which you touched upon, but also technology. You think that we can come up with the technological answers to solve the problem of global warming. Is that right?
We can't solve the whole problem. There's no way that this could be implemented, even in the United States and Europe, in less than several decades. You cannot build the machines fast enough to replace them in a decade. I wish my environmental friends would stop the numerology about how many percent below 1990 we're going to cut in 2020. The number that matters between now and 2020 is how many billions are we going to spend inventing new technology to do the job after 2020. The key is we've got to cut like 50 to 80% by the middle of the century. The bad news is that's a lot of cutting. The good news is that's a lot of time. So if we focus so much on the next 5 or 10 years, you know, political lifetime of members of Congress, then what we're going to miss is the opportunity to make the long-term investments in a more orderly manner that really provide us with the technologies that we can use to substitute. So you don't shut down every coal plant tomorrow. As much as an environmental guy think that would be great, we can't do that. It's economically catastrophic. So what you do is you don't replace them. As they go out, now you, in an orderly way, replace them with a whole range of alternatives. And we have what I like to call a learning by doing feeding frenzy. Get out there and let the market of new tech compete. Let's find out which ones are going to be cost effective, socially acceptable.
Steve Snyder is a professor at Stanford University, a member of the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, and the author of a new book. We'll be visiting with him more in the coming weeks.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Well, I think right now we as a society and as a world are faced with some really staggering problems, whether they're the health care that we've talked about or the environment or energy. And solving any of those problems is going to take a concerted effort from, it doesn't matter what discipline you're thinking of going into, you can make a contribution to that. And, you know, I think that that's, if I was a young person out now setting out in a new field, or sitting out to you know, work and make a career for myself, I would be looking at some of these, you know, really major problems and thinking about, you know, what can I do to make a difference here? Because whether you're going to, you know, go into banking or politics or industry or what have you, I guarantee you there's a place for you to make a strong impact there. So, you know, the world's an exciting place, but it's going to change, and best way to predict what that change is going to be is to take part in it. So that would be my advice for the young people out there. I'm Jim Heath. I'm a professor of chemistry at California Institute of Technology.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
We live tomorrow, 'cause you know what will be there. I am waiting for you. I am waiting for you.